This winter, keep your home warm and help lower your energy bills with Warmflow, the home heating experts. With an eco-friendly range of high-efficiency oil boilers and Zeno R290 air and ground source heat pumps, Warmflow provides home heating solutions designed to save you money while keeping you cozy, whatever the weather. Trusted for over 50 years, Warmflow delivers heating that works smarter, not harder. For all your home heating needs, visit warmflow.co.uk.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. I hope you're slipping nicely into 2026. Sounds a bit weird. I got that sort of look of disgust from Marisa Sullivan, our producer that I'm so familiar with. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about mini-brains. The researchers working on mini-brains, I'll let you know, do not like that term at all because it's problematic in many ways. They're not mini-brains. They don't want people thinking, oh, are these things alive? They're little clumps of brain cells. But in the future, and I mean, far distant future, it sounds like, these might be helpful in helping us move away from animal models and also try to figure out how disease affects the brain. We're going to be talking about that and exploring what exactly junk DNA is with our friend, Dr. Kevin Mitchell. And we'll get to all of your comments as well. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the program. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Fergus McAuliffe, Head of Research Engagement and Impact at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the School of Natural Sciences at University of Galway. You're both very welcome. I wanted to start off 2026 to show that actually we revisit the same thing over and over again. Like, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Fergus, our first story is about paleontologists fighting over the beginnings of man.
Exactly. So this story all revolves around walking. Now, walking is a really important thing, but it's also crucial to the field of paleontology because it's used as one of the key distinguishers between humans and apes. Now, 20 years ago, a fossilized skull was found in Chad. And due to a particular hole at the base of that skull through which the spinal cord entered, the French paleontologist that found it, he regarded it as our earliest known ancestor because it appeared that the skull was sitting on the shoulders as opposed to hanging from the shoulders, i.e. upright walking.
Now, you would say that if you're a paleontologist, that's exactly what you'd say. This is the most important find, the one that I found, the most important find in archaeology.
Exactly. And he became hugely famous in France at the time. However, like all good paleontology stories, there were many detractors and some were quite unconvinced, saying that more bones needed to be found and analysed. Now, they did actually find another thigh bone and another arm bone. And this week, a fresh interpretation of those fossils was published. Now, what they found is that the femoral bone, there's a slight bump on it, and this appears to be the attachment point for the largest and most powerful ligament in the body. Now, it's the ligament that, when you stand up, it prevents your torso from falling backwards and falling side to side.
Okay.
I.e., you probably need it when you're walking upright.
Uh-huh.
However, and so as a result of that, he said that this adds credence to the idea that this particular fossil from 7 million years ago, so much older than other ones from the Rift Valley, that this is from an upright hominin, i.e. One of our earliest ancestors. However, because it is paleontology, there was a fight and there's huge controversy about this because others have said that the case is really weak and it could still point to other apes. Others have said that particular bump that was found on the thigh bone, it's very faint and the bone was already highly damaged in its own right. And others said this actually still doesn't bring clarity as to whether the hominin was, or the creature was walking upright in trees or upright on the ground. And it's the latter. It's walking upright on the ground that is the key distinguisher as to whether it is human lineage or not.
How do you walk upright on a tree?
You can do it like temporarily. However, you'd probably be using your hands as well from the other branches. You'll see kind of...
Sorry, I was thinking like the person would be horizontal and they walk up the tree.
No. It's walking like...
You'd need very sticky feet for that.
Yeah, you'd need very sticky feet, indeed.
But I think the quote of the, or the most important quote to come out of this is actually from the lead researcher themselves, who said, in my view, in a remarkable case of self-awareness and situational awareness, that this is a case of too few fossils and too many researchers.
Interesting. God, it never ends with paleontologists. I'd love to be, like, the whole Indiana Jones thing, you know, where they're like running around, they're beating each other up. I like think that's real. I think it was a documentary. I think Indiana Jones is a documentary. My second story, Jessamine, has to do with aviation emissions, and any story that sounds so, you know, positive, I just have a feel of a cynicism and skepticism towards. What is this story?
Yeah, so this is interesting in that it's about the emissions, the carbon emissions that are coming from flying. And we hear a lot about, right, how one of the main ways that you can cut your carbon footprint is by reducing the amount of flights that you take. Unfortunately, you know, the industry is still expanding. There's more and more flights happening. And sometimes it can feel like, oh, can we really do anything about this or not? There's this new survey that was done by researchers led from Linnaeus University, where they actually went back to 2023 flight data and they analyzed over 27 million flights that were taken that year.
So, wow.
Like covering 3.5 billion passengers, which is kind of amazing. And they went to look at the efficiency of basically how much carbon was being emitted, like per passenger, per kilometer that they flew. And they went looking for trends, right, to see basically, are there ways to make flying more efficient? And especially, are there ways that we could do now? Because it's not realistic to expect people to just stop flying. And especially, you know, when I think about not flying, it's like, well, my mom lives on another continent. I'm still going to fly some. But how can we reduce the overall emissions from flights? And what they found was actually there are three recommendations that you could do to create a 50 to 75% reduction in emissions very quickly. And what they are, just to lead with that, firstly, just flying the most fuel-efficient aircraft, right? Like not relying on older, much less fuel-efficient aircraft, which then create more emissions. They also recommended increasing passenger loads. You know, lots of flights fly not empty, but at, you know, maybe 20 to 50% capacity, especially like this time of year. So increasing passenger loads. And then this one will be the toughest to actually do, but all economy layouts. So everyone has the least legroom possible. Obviously, if you have more passengers on a flight, the more efficient that is in terms of the carbon that's being emitted per kilometer per passenger. That one's going to be probably a hard sell just economically, but like those business class, first class seats, they do emit about five times as much carbon compared to like an economy seat.
But those people are five times more important.
Are they? Or are they just too wealthy? So, I mean, basically, you know, to get the maximum reduction, some of these changes will be hard to implement. But these researchers actually also found that an 11% reduction in these emissions could be achieved immediately just by prioritizing efficiency in airlines, like without replacing entire fleets of aircraft, without, you know, removing business class as a thing. You could actually realize incredible increases in efficiency. The thing is, you need policies to be different, right? You need there to be an actual penalty for airlines or aircraft that are over-emitting.
Yeah, and they don't love that. There's a big lobby to say we want to fly more. See, in this very country, we see that problem. You know, I think we should just build an enormous bridge, but apparently you can't do that. You just can't build a bridge between here and France. Apparently France is quite far away. And you have to get a boat there.
They looked at the differences of like larger airports are more efficient or like really big airplanes on long haul flights are more efficient.
That's for sure. Our third story has to do with migrions. This is a new term for me, Fergus. What the hell is a migrion?
It's a new term for everyone.
Oh.
So
don't feel so bad then.
So to understand what a migrion is, we need to understand a little bit about how viruses move. So we know that viruses can't reproduce on their own. So what they do is that they invade a host cell and they hijack that host cell's machinery to make more of themselves.
Oh.
But a key question was, how do viruses move between cells once in the body? And researchers in Peking University, they've discovered a pretty unexpected route using the vesicular stomatitis virus, so VSV. And what they found is that typically viruses will spread through the passive release of individual virions in the body. However, in the case of this particular virus, they've found essentially a method that supercharges the infection because it supercharges transport within the body. So what had recently been discovered was a transport structure called a migrosome. And what they found is a type of migrosome that, when hijacked, transports viruses. And that's what's called the migrion. So to explain that, I'll give an analogy. When you're moving house and you have a lot of stuff, you might need to hire a moving van.
Always hire a moving van.
The pallets that you put onto the moving van, they're the migrosomes. And so you only need them when things are being transported. But if those migrosomes get hijacked by a virus, then they become these migrions. And what it means is that when the moving van arrives at the new house, i.e. a new cell, all the pallets are unloaded. They look like friendly pallets, but once inside the cell, they release this huge supercharged amount of viruses, and it really amplifies the replication and the dispersal of the viruses. And they think that this could be a way of explaining why certain infections escalate so quickly.
Very good. Our final story, Jessamine, is about ants. It's quite a sad story, really.
Well, it's interesting, right? And in a way, this comes back to this question of how do we stop infection from spreading in different living organisms? So if you think about it, if one of us was sick, right? If one of us was sick and we live in a city and we're moving around, who do you tell? You know, you need help, you need additional resources, but also you don't want to infect other people. You don't want to get other people involved necessarily. Unfortunately, a lot of us have had a recent experience with worrying about how do we spread or not spread diseases. And this is actually really, really important in ant colonies, because if you think about them, they're really crowded. You know, all the ants are packed underground. And actually, as well, in ant colonies, most of the ants are related, right? They don't all reproduce. So they're sharing a lot of the same genetic vulnerability. So how do you prevent epidemics from spreading?
Right.
And the answer is that there's a lot of different strategies that ants have evolved. But researchers in the Institute for Science and Technology in Austria just found a new one, which is basically ants that are unwell, sending out a signal that says, I'm sick, I'm not going to make it, please kill me. And this works in the colony for the colony to survive and prevent the spread of disease from that one individual ant. So there's other strategies that have been
observed. This is like a pheromone or something? Sort of a molecule it gives off?
It's a chemical. It's a smell, if you like. And basically, what it comes down to is, you know, some ants, when the adult is sick, it will actually just leave the colony and be like, all right, I'm out of here. Good luck to you guys. And that's, you know, that's altruism, effectively, from that one ant. It's saying, I want the colony to survive, so I'm going to take one for the team and leave. But there are young ants, they're called pupae, which are sitting in little cocoons. They're tended for by the adult worker ants, and they can't leave, right? They're not able to just get up and walk out of the colony yet. So how do they let other ants know, like, this is not going well for me, I want the colony to succeed, therefore I need to get out of here? And what they do is they release the smell. That basically the worker ants around them then notice and say, oh, you know what, they do this process which is called destructive disinfection, where basically the worker ant comes in, opens up the little cocoon that the ant is in, and releases a disinfectant that neutralizes the infection, but also kills the young ant.
I have a problem with the anthropomorphization of this story. Well, like, how do we know the pupae are releasing a message saying, I'm sick, I'm going to infect everyone, kill me, and not just releasing a molecule that everyone goes, oh, get them, they're sick, as opposed
well,
to, like, why?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, right? Because actually different species have different strategies for this. And in a lot of animal species, right, if there is a sick or injured animal, they can experience aggressive behavior from other animals, but not generally from kin. So most species, they will tell other animals that they are related to that they're sick, that they're injured, and often there are strategies for, like, helping those animals. And actually, that's true in ants as well. They have pheromone signals in some species of ants that can indicate, like, I'm injured, please help me, and then the other ants help them. But in this case, for situations where the ant is not going to make it, there's no amount of help that will make a difference, there's a different chemical that's being released. And it's really cool. They did a few tests to make sure that this was, like, actually what is happening, that there was a cause and effect thing here too. Like, they looked, if there's no adults around, does the pupae release this chemical? No, it doesn't. But if they take the chemical and then they put it onto, like, a healthy little pupae that's in a cocoon, then an adult worker ant comes in and starts taking the cocoon apart. So they looked at a lot of the things for this, because I agree, there's an issue a lot of times with stories about animals or insects and being like, oh, they're just like us.
They fell in love.
Yeah.
He's very regretful right now.
Yeah, this is the noble sacrifice part of the ant story. But it's interesting, right? Because the other thing about ant colonies is that they're all genetically related. So in a way, you might think this is altruism, but also that ant is protecting its genetic heritage by making sure that the colony survives.
The selfish gene. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, Dr. Fergus McAuliffe, thank you very much. Now, mini brains are grown in the lab and they can be incredibly powerful tools for studying how the brain might work. But they've had a major limitation, and that is they don't last long enough to fully model any sort of disease. So researchers at the University of Galway have found a way by giving brains blood vessels. Here to tell us all about it is Dr. Mihai Lamora from Curum, the Research Centre for Medical Devices based in the University of Galway. Mihai, welcome to the programme. We've talked a lot about these organoids over the years on the program, but for those who aren't familiar, can you just explain what a mini brain is, please?
Yeah, so hey, Jonathan, and thank you very much for the invitation. So first of all, I might say the mini brain is not really the correct terminology for this type of, how I would call them, some clumps of tissues. So practically, we should correctly imagine them as reductionist replicas of the real human brain. Yeah, so practically there are...
Yeah, it's not as easy to say, though, is it?
No, it's not, definitely not. Yeah, so there are definitely some immature clumps of tissue that we're creating that should, in principle, replicate some key features of the human brain. Yeah, there's a lot of debate there whether they really reflect the human brain, but they actually don't. Yeah, so I think the more correct terminology would be cerebral, yeah, because of the brain, and organoids. So organ from an organ, and then you have the suffix oid, O-I-D, at the end, which actually means resembling, like, or having the form of. So practically, that's why we call them cerebral organoids, because they resemble the human brain, but they are not so complex as the real human brain. Yeah, so you can imagine that the human brain is actually one of the most complex organ in our body. Yeah, so practically mini brains, more correctly called cerebral organoids, are some clumps of tissues that resemble the real human brain, but they are not actually human brains.
No, yeah, that mini brains is a bit of a misnomer, but they're essentially connections, collections of neurons stuck together that can communicate and can sort of give an idea of how things happen in the brain without being very useful right now. How big are these guys?
Yeah, so so practically they are around the size of a zebrafish brain, so around between 3 and 5 millimeters. Yeah, so if you consider the human brain, it's like considering it as a sphere, even though it's incorrect. That's around 100 to 150 millimeters in diameter. So it's actually 50 times bigger as compared with the real human brain. So these cerebral organoids are really tiny in terms of size.
Right, and. So they're not like a section of the brain, is that right? They're constructed or grown together, so it's not like you're splicing out a tiny bit of the brain to look at it like a biopsy.
No, you create this from scratch in the lab. So practically, you're taking some kind of stem cells. So imagine that the scientists can take skin cells from a patient, and then this can be reprogrammed in the lab to recreate this. Reprogram stem cells. And then these stem cells are grown in a dish practically to try to assemble using a protein gel. And then in time, you can add the right nutrients in order to grow as this mini cerebral organoid. So it's not something that you're taking from a human as a biopsy for sure.
That sounds ridiculously complicated. Why do you go through all of that? Why don't you just take a little piece of someone's brain? It's only like a couple of millimeters. You can have a bit of mine.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Would you like to have something embedded in your brain and then taking out? I don't think it's very comfortable. So it's definitely, it raises a lot of ethical concerns. So
is the difference from just, you know, taking a section of a cadaver's brain? Is it that this brain is functioning and alive, or why don't you take donations of cadavers?
Yeah, so I suppose that once you have a cadaver, then they probably won't have a functioning brain. Yeah, so I'm not sure how much the brain will still function after the individual dies. However, it still raises a lot of ethical concerns. So ideally, you want to recreate this in the lab so that you have like a model that you can control in the lab rather than relying on cadavers.
That makes sense. And I'm actually trying to get there while going through a rather childish way. But I totally understand that ethically, and you know, to be able to reiterate with this, you need to be able to grow them in the lab. when you say clump, that was a word that stuck out to me. These brain organoids, they don't have the same structure as a brain, do they? They're not as packed and as organized as a real part of the human brain, or are they?
No, so they do grow very randomly. So I think that the scientists are recreating different organoids that resemble different regions of the brain. So it's very difficult to like know exactly, okay, this part is like a specific region of the brain. So yeah, so I think it's we're still at the early stages to be able to recreate the entire regions of the brain. Yeah, so I think that there are researchers that are working towards like combining these two multiple cerebral organoids to create this so-called assembloids, so that it's increasing the complexity and then just to reflect a bit better the architecture of the human brain. But we're not there yet.
So someone listening to this would be wondering, why on earth do you bother? It sounds like an extraordinary amount of effort to get something that isn't a very good analog of the brain anyway, doesn't have the same structure as it, dies pretty quickly, and doesn't model disease very well. Why are we pursuing this area of research at all?
Yeah, well, if you think about how we're trying to get drugs on the market now, so we rely on animal models. Yes, yeah, so whatever we're trying to produce at this moment is just we're looking at the brains of like rats or mice to understand actually the human brains, which actually, yeah, we're looking at different species. So for now, I think it's important to recreate these cerebral organoids so that the more we investigate it, the more complex they become. They will develop into a very important tool, right, to understand the human brain. Yeah.
And look, and that makes total sense. If you can't get them from humans ethically, getting them from animals, you come up against the same argument. So you're trying to improve how these models function because, as you say, testing how certain neurons might react to a particular drug, what activity you might see, that could be really useful. You've tried to introduce blood vessels. How does that work?
Yeah, so practically when you grow these clumps of tissue, the bigger they grow, the oxygen and then nutrients in the core of the cerebral organoids, they make it difficult to reach within the core. Yeah, so practically what happens within the inner core, you get those cells start to die. And then the idea is to introduce this blood vessel so that it will allow the oxygen and then the nutrients to pass through the entirety of the organoid, and then hopefully they can grow for longer time. So like this, you can use these models to, let's say, design them for like specific diseases, which takes time to look at them. So for instance, Alzheimer or Parkinson diseases, where, you know, they are neurodegenerative diseases. So that requires a lot of time. So you need to keep the systems alive as long as possible.
Right.
So
what's the current shelf life of a cerebral organoid?
Yeah, well, without blood vessels, so probably they will last for a few months. However, with the blood vessels, you can keep them in culture. Now, it's very interesting to see because there was a recent study, I think from Harvard University, if I'm not wrong, where they managed to keep these cerebral organoids for up to 7 years.
Oh, wow. So you actually probably would be able to model something like cognitive decline, or at least how a drug might prevent certain cells from dying, or links between synapses and so on.
Definitely, yes. Yeah. Now, you have to think that the human brain takes like around 2 decades to develop, to become mature.
Yeah.
So we're not there yet, but then still it's a huge progress as far as,
Because you've created these cells from skin cells, so they never really came from a human. Is there any ethical concerns with keeping cerebral organoids alive? If you create systems that have larger, I mean, say we managed to get to a stage where there was, you know, you managed to make an organoid the size of a plum, you know, would there be ethical concerns about keeping, you know, cerebral matter that essentially is capable of thought and independence and all that? Would there be any ethical questions because the cells originally came from skin cells?
Well, not necessarily. So the way that we do it, we're just having these cells commercially available. So typically the companies are dealing with those ethical concerns. However, yes, there needs to be a consent form in place. So I think that's actually one of the things that it's very important in terms of like the ethical aspect. However, they are not so developed so that they can think that they can think or feel pain, or they can become conscious or sentient. So I don't think there is any concern in that regard. However, if you, let's say, implant them in animals, so you can create these human animal chimeras, yeah, so practically implanting these organoids into animals raises concern about humanizing animal brains.
Why would you do that? If you don't want to get, you know, the brain tissue from an animal, why would you then put it into an animal?
Yeah, so practically you want to see how this will behave within an animal. Yeah, so let's say that even when you create blood vessels, yeah, so there were studies where they had a bit of like blood vessels within these cerebral organoids, and then they implanted them in an animal to see how they connect with that existent vasculature, so those blood vessels that are already in the animal. So this will be one strategy to look at. Yeah, you can still use animal models to try to identify this.
You want to see whether or not the blood vessels behave in a similar way as they would in a living human, because you're kind of sticking it all together in a bit of a Frankenstein-y way, and you want to make sure that what you're creating is a decent model for what you're trying to understand.
Well, exactly, but still, it's still, we're looking at two different species, yeah, so two different sources. So again, it's really to understand probably the blood vessel connection in that respect. But other than this, it will still not reflect the real situation, right, where you have
a human. Would a host body not reject human DNA?
Well, probably. I'm not an expert to be able to reply to that question.
Okay.
But I suppose that, yeah, there should be some genetic match to be able to accept it. But however, in that study, it didn't look like the human cerebral organoids were rejected by that animal body. So I would say that the other way might be quite interesting, but definitely it won't be possible to test.
So obviously the quickest way to test drugs, the quickest way to get around all of the questions about a brain is to create a non-physical version, a digital version of the brain that was a perfect digital twin of a human brain. I know there's a lot of work going on in that area, trying to map how neurons connect to each other and how they might behave and so on. It's a very difficult and technical project, and you know it will take a very, very long time. But do you need to do this sort of work to be able to build that model, or can you build a model without creating organoids? Would you be able to build a successful digital twin of the brain without having to make organoids?
So that would be probably quite complicated and will require a lot of multidisciplinary backgrounds and expertise, I would say. At least the AI and computational calculations, even before going to the experimental approach. So I think it would be...
But there is work in that area, right? There is work in looking at drug disease using digital twins of people and brains and organs and so on.
Yeah, there is a lot of the research in that direction. However, it depends on the type of model. So ideally, what you would have different systems that you can use to ideally to replace in the future the animal studies. So then one of the systems could give you some useful information that cannot be reproduced probably by a different model that maybe lacks a specific properties that you would like to look at. So
yeah.
They're both very interesting, and then it requires a lot of attention, but definitely a lot of effort in developing like different models. Specifically what you're mentioning there in terms of digital twin.
Very interesting, Dr. Mihai Lamora. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much as well, Jonathan.
As it's a new year, we should probably say, we've said it a few times over the years on the program, just to talk a little bit for a second about animal testing. The reality of the landscape is that no matter how much you want to reduce harm, there's a lot of science that we talk about on this program that does involve accessing, you know, the brains of rats and so on. And in the best case scenarios, those animals are disposed of very quickly and humanely. The truth is that that isn't always perfect, and that across the world, a lot of animal research isn't where it should be. And so when we talk about on this program about animal research, I don't want, even though we'd be glib about using animals in research, it's just for the speed of accessing rather than having to address this every single time. But just because it's the beginning of the new year, just want to say fully aware that animal research is problematic, isn't always ideal, and can often cause harm to the animals involved. So don't want to pass over that, but just so I've said it on the program in case anyone thinks I'm being very, you know, I'm passing over that particular question. Right, on the way, what exactly is junk DNA? Now, some of your comments from last week's pod. Kate Adamala, Associate Professor of Genetics, Cell Biology and Development at the University of Minnesota, was talking about mirror cells. It was absolutely amazing. Colm says, wow, fantastic discussion on chirality and mirror cells. If you didn't hear it, I do recommend you listen back. It was amazing to think about, but also really interesting to see a scientist who just stopped research because she was worried she was going to destroy the world. That's an interesting story. We were also talking about life on Mars with Matthew Gilliam. He's the director of Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence in Plants for Space at the University of Adelaide. And he was talking to us about how to build plants in space and what the challenges are. Lucy says, I'm intrigued by the ethical considerations of this and how space agriculture research weighs up against focusing resources on current earthbound sustainability problems. We did kind of touch on that, Lucy. And the thing is, you know, a lot of the time research that you do for space is also really useful for the Earth as well. So, you know, like that example we use all the time, you know, we got Teflon and we got Wi-Fi and all that sort of stuff from the space program. Innovation is a good idea in and of itself. It doesn't really matter which way you point it, I think. Anyway, that's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.